Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Creating a Family, talk about infertility and adoption. I'm Dawn Davenport. I'm the director of Creating a Family, and we're a nonprofit providing resources, education, and support for infertility and adoption. You can find us at creatingafamily.org. Each week I post a blog on a topic usually relevant to infertility or adoption. This week my blog is about how to prepare your children for the adoption of a sibling. Check it out and share your thoughts. And please, if you've had this experience, if you could share your been there, done that knowledge on the comment section, you can find us at the blog page of creatingafamily.org. I post regularly on Facebook and Twitter about infertility, PCOS, adoption, life in general. On Twitter, you can find me at DawnDavenport1. Facebook, I'm Dawn.Davenport1. And you can also join the Creating a Family Facebook group, where we routinely share interesting talks. You can find that Creating a Family Facebook group by typing in the words Creating a Family in the Facebook search box. Also, you might want to consider following our Twitter list. We have the largest infertility trying to conceive list, as well as the largest adoption lists on Twitter, and you can easily find those. The fastest way is just to go to my page, which is Dawn Davenport 1, click on the either adoptions list or infertility list, and click follow. It's a great way to follow lots and lots of other people in Twitter land who have an interest in this subject and tweet about it. We publish a video on our adoption and infertility video pages every couple of weeks. A video you might find interesting is endometriosis. You can find it on our infertility video page or on our YouTube channel. This show, as well as all the resources provided by Creating a Family, could not happen without the generous support of all of our sponsors, including our goal sponsors. Children's Connection is a licensed adoption agency with a Connecting Hearts Domestic Adoption Program, a Crystal Angels Embryo Adoption Program, as well as an providing international adoption services and home study services in Texas for all types of adoptions. We also have Beacon House Adoption, which provides domestic private adoptions, as well as having an accredited adoption program in Russia. They also are going to be sponsoring an educational seminar as part of the Southeast Adoption Coalition. It's going to be their first annual Education Adoption Expo. It's going to be held October 23rd in Baton Rouge. If you live anywhere in that area, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Florida, wherever, consider checking it out. I've looked at the website and the list of speakers and topics, and it really looks good. You can find them on southeastadopt.webs.com. To get more information about these sponsors, as well as all of our other sponsors, click on their logo or name on the right-hand column of our site. We also have a relatively new database of our sponsors, and they're going to be divided between infertility and adoption. You can find an infertility service provider, such as a clinic or a donor or surrogacy agency, or an adoption service provider, such as an agency. On that page, you can search by location or services provided, as well as a host of other important criteria. And then you can click on the sponsor there and go to a profile page and get additional information. Last but not least, if you are interested in becoming a sponsor to help us continue to bring you this show and our videos and website, we would love to talk with you. Now, today's show is going to be on the latest diagnosis and treatment options for polycystic ovarian syndrome. Our guest is Dr. Allison Peck. She is a reproductive endocrinologist specializing in the treatment of PCOS, and she is with the Fertility Institute's Endocrine Disorder Division in Encino, California, which is near Los Angeles. Welcome, Dr. Peck, to Creating a Family.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here and be able to be helpful to all those patients out there that are dealing, struggling, or interested in learning more about polycystic ovarian syndrome.
You know, it is a confusing disease, and I think it would help if we start at the beginning just to make sure that everybody is on the same page, understanding-wise. Can you give us a general explanation of exactly what we mean by polycystic ovarian syndrome, and why is it called a syndrome?
Absolutely. Great place to start. So polycystic ovarian syndrome is pretty self-explanatory in the definition. Polycystic ovary stands for an ovary that has many small cysts, and syndrome allows there to be a multitude of symptoms that patients may complain of that don't have to, the patients don't have to have all of those symptoms, but they may have a couple. And so it's a syndrome because not every patient suffering from polycystic ovarian syndrome will complain of the same symptoms.
So what are the more common symptoms that somebody might have? If they have these, they might wonder if they have PCOS.
Well, starting off, usually a patient will complain of having irregular menstrual cycles. So first you have to know what a regular menstrual cycle is to say that you have an irregular menstrual cycle. So I would say, number one, that's the most common symptom. A regular menstrual cycle usually would be anywhere from 25 to 35 days in intervals. So a woman that knows that they get their period on average every month is most likely having regular menstrual cycles. A woman who cannot even say that and can't even remember the last time they had their period, that would be somebody who potentially would have one of the most common symptoms of polycystic ovarian syndrome.
It doesn't matter or not whether or not she's ovulating, but if she is regular, that's the first thing to know. If you are irregular, not having a cycle approximately every month, 25 to 35 days, then that is one symptom that would
exactly.
make you suspect. Okay.
Okay. And when I say a regular menstrual cycle, regularity usually means ovulation.
Oh, okay.
Because our bodies are set up in a way, our women's bodies are set up in a way that ovulation allows that regularity. Women who do not routinely ovulate will not have regular menstrual cycles.
Okay. All right, what's another common symptom then?
Exactly. Another common symptom would be hyperandrogenism, anything related to hyperandrogenism. And although that's a medical term, what it actually means is hyper-elevated androgenism, levels of male hormones in the blood. So all women have male hormones, but some women have a higher amount of male hormones circulating in their system, or some women have not such a high level, but the amount that's active and able to produce symptoms is higher. So they would complain of things like hirsutism, which is a medical term meaning male pattern hair growth. So similar to where a man would potentially shave is where a woman may complain of hair growth. So on the upper lip, in the chin area, underneath the neck, on the sideburns, and a different distribution around in the body as well. So that's one of the more other common complaints, or acne. So typically a patient would come in with irregular periods and some type of male symptomatology. Okay?
Okay. Is there any other symptom that we need to mention before we move on that would be common enough for people to, or are those the three biggies?
Those are the most common symptoms. Once in a while, women will complain if they have severe male symptomatology of hair loss, which could be a whole multitude of reasons why women have hair loss, but it's in a male pattern balding, either temporal balding or somewhere towards the top of the head.
Yeah, that would make sense as well. So what do we know about the causes of polycystic ovarian syndrome?
Okay, well, at this point in time, we don't exactly know what causes polycystic ovarian syndrome, but we do have definite ideas. One being that potentially at some point in time, it is going to be shown to be some genetic predisposition. It's not uncommon that you have a patient coming in complaining of these symptoms, and they will mention that their first-degree relatives suffered the same symptoms. So probably
that's interesting, because I was going to ask about that, the genetic connection. Okay, so they're probably... We don't know for sure, but we'll eventually figure that one out, you think?
Yeah, there are a couple of hints of why we think how our enzymes are working, that within that molecular mechanism, there are some genetic predispositions to polycystic ovarian syndrome. But another reason that has become into play is high levels of insulin. Now, this is not a part of the diagnosis of polycystic ovarian syndrome, but it has been found in multiple literature that insulin does play an active role in the syndrome. And insulin comes from a different endocrine organ in our body, which is the pancreas, but high levels of insulin, which could come with potentially being women that are overweight or suffering from obesity, could also perpetuate a lot of the symptoms of polycystic ovarian syndrome and leading to high male hormone levels, which in turn throws off their ovulation pattern, which gives them irregular periods. So at this point in time, we don't really know what comes first. Is it the chicken or the egg? Is it the high insulin levels that are driving this whole mechanism? Or is it the level of high male hormones that are driving this mechanism?
Well, let me ask a question. Does being overweight cause PCOS, or is it being overweight a symptom of PCOS?
In the true definition of polycystic ovarian syndrome, a weight is not a factor. However, the majority of patients, or let's say anywhere from 50 to 60% of patients with polycystic ovarian syndrome, are either weight or obese. But you do not have to be overweight or obese to suffer from PCOS.
So about 40%, 40 to 50% would have a normal BMI and still
exactly.
have PCOS. Okay.
Exactly. You don't have to be, like I said, obese or overweight to have polycystic ovarian syndrome. But because of this issue with insulin, and because patients with polycystic ovarian syndrome tend to have more metabolic disturbances that could lead to an increase in weight or lead to an increased risk of heart disease or high blood pressure or throwing off their lipid panels, that is a very important part of the syndrome that I do discuss with all my patients, but it does not make the diagnosis.
Okay, so for the diagnosis, we're looking for an irregular menstrual cycle and some of the symptoms of excessive male hormones, which could be the hair pattern, either growth or loss or acne or something along those lines.
Exactly. And then one other part of the syndrome that it's good to go back to when making the diagnosis, that depending on who you're listening to in terms of expert societies in making your PCOS diagnosis, will include or won't include the appearance of polycystic appearing ovaries on an ultrasound exam. Because a patient would never know if they have polycystic appearing ovaries unless somebody did some type of exam on them to know that. You wouldn't feel them in any way. So some experts will actually insist that a woman has an ultrasound performed to look at their ovaries to help confirm that diagnosis, or some won't because they feel that that's not going to be a part of their diagnosis.
If you do not have the multiple cysts on your ovaries, would that rule out that you have PCOS?
Not necessarily. Again, we're talking about a syndrome here. So in a syndrome, again, depending on which society you're following and really confirming that diagnosis, some would not include having an ultrasound findings in that diagnosis. So in answer to that question, yes, you would still be able to be suffering from PCOS, even if your ovaries don't look like a classic polycystic appearing ovary on an ultrasound or on a surgery.
So for a diagnosis, it sounds like this is that right now, to be diagnosed, you're looking at the symptoms. You're looking at the person's menstrual cycle, and you're looking for presence or symptoms of excessive higher levels of male hormones. Is there any type of blood test? People talk about having their insulin, if they're borderline diabetic. Is there any type of blood test for either male hormones or for insulin or anything that could help with a diagnosis?
Absolutely. So again, depending on who you're following and what you believe, in terms of the high male hormones, if a patient's complaining of symptoms to many physicians, that's enough. Because whether or not the levels are going to be elevated in the blood, they know that's the patient's complaint, and it falls along with the other conditions. However, to really confirm the diagnosis, it's best for you to rule out any other abnormal labs that could cause similar symptoms. So there are blood tests, and again, I think every physician probably does a different panel, but for the most part, you do some basic male hormone blood testing, like things for testosterone, either free testosterone or total testosterone, and another hormone that's DHEAS, which comes from the adrenal gland, because there isn't only one place in the body where these male hormones come from. They can come from the ovary, and they can come from the adrenal gland, or they can come from our peripheral tissues like our fat tissue. So one part of the panel usually would include checking these male hormones, and some physicians may check more than that. I generally start with those two. Worst case scenario, a patient had a quickly growing tumor that's going to be producing high levels of male hormones, you would expect, not always, but these levels would be very high, and they could cause similar symptoms to polycystic ovarian syndrome, but by no means would that be the first thing they're suffering from. So some clinicians do it just to rule out that there's not an extremely elevated level, that they have to be on high alert, that there's something to be looking for in the body.
Mm-hmm.
Other than the male hormones, you do want to rule out other endocrine problems that could present in the same way, like abnormalities in their thyroid gland. The thyroid gland helps us with our metabolism, and one of the main complaints that women with thyroid problems will come in saying is that they have irregular menstrual cycles. So you want to rule out that their thyroid gland is working pretty much okay.
And you can do that through a blood test.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And if you find that it's abnormal, really you want to try and correct that. Working with the symptoms and trying to make a patient with PCOS get better is not going to correct their thyroid in any way. So that would be another part. Another thing is something called prolactin. Prolactin is a hormone that comes to our body. It helps us with milk production, and it's secreted from a small endocrine gland at the base of the brain. And if those levels are high, that can also cause irregular periods. And so you do want to rule out that that's not the reason why a person's having irregular periods or high levels of androgens or male hormones. That's primarily part of some of the initial tests patients should have. There are a couple other tests. The adrenal gland I mentioned before, there is a specific syndrome called congenital adrenal hyperplasia. And I don't want to get too technical on your show, but for the most part, some patients that suffer from that syndrome, which could present very similarly to PCOS, will complain usually of an excess amount of hirsutism, or the hair growth we were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So I routinely, if a patient's primary complaint is hirsutism, then I would include that in my panel to rule that out.
And what is the, it's a blood test, and it's a blood test for, tell me the
it's
name.
It's a blood test for 17-hydroxyprogesterone, which is a hormone that would be elevated in patients that had congenital adrenal hyperplasia. Now, I don't want to throw your listeners off, because this would be a rarer diagnosis, but how patients present. So as a doctor, you want to be really comprehensive in your approach and not miss something, because the treatment for that would be very different.
Well, you raise a good question. I hear from people not infrequently that they are seeking a diagnosis from their OBGYN or regular general practitioner or internist. If they are struggling with getting a diagnosis and they're listening to this show and they hear a lot of these symptoms that they haven't been effective at getting, or they feel like their doctor is probably not running some of these tests, what type of doctor should they see if they suspect that they have PCOS? Should they be going to their OBGYN? Is an internist enough?
I think it's fair to start with your OBGYN, because usually when a woman's having a problem with their periods, that's the first person they would naturally go to. And through the field of OBGYN there's our subdivision of reproductive endocrinology and infertility, and ideally they should really land with an expert in that area. But I think it's fair to start with the OBGYN, because everyone is trained overall to know about PCOS, but the reproductive endocrinologists are the ones that are really working with women and their and how their hormones could get off, and try and help them correct those.
So even if they're not, we're going to talk about fertility issues in a minute, but even if they're not struggling with fertility or they're not trying to conceive, they should still be at a, if they're having trouble getting a diagnosis or having trouble treating, they should be seeing a reproductive endocrinologist, even though in our minds a lot of people think and equate an RE, reproductive endocrinologist, with fertility treatment. That's not all an RE can do. They can also treat other forms of endocrine problems, of which PCOS is one. Is that an accurate summation?
That's an accurate, very appropriate statement. It's
okay.
Not to say that a medical endocrinologist can't treat this as well, but our specialty is specifically focused on many patients that are suffering from this syndrome, whether it's just from a medical standpoint or it's from a fertility standpoint at some point, because I didn't mention before, but one of the other symptoms that patients come in with is infertility.
If they're trying to conceive, that's right. Yeah, okay. So we're going to talk about that in just a second. Before we do that, however, I want to get Leah's question in. She says, I'm about 100 pounds overweight and have been diagnosed with PCOS. I've been struggling with my weight since I was about 16. I was a skinny kid until that time. I eat relatively healthy and walk about 5 times a week. I cannot seem to lose weight no matter what I do. I have been on drastic diets, and even then I lose less than expected. I have a very slow metabolism. Is this metabolism caused by my PCOS? Would PCOS meds help me lose weight?
I would say that thank you for the story that you share with me, and that's a very typical story that I hear in the majority of my patients, so you're absolutely not alone. Having said that, yes, many of the medications that could help with PCOS could also help with your symptoms and your issue with metabolism. So I hinted at this before when we were talking about insulin issues, but patients with PCOS tend to have a much more difficult time than an average counterpart that's overweight or obese losing weight. And that's because their insulin levels are usually elevated, and that makes their metabolism not function the same. So although, again, it's not part of the diagnosis, since we do witness at least 7% of our patients having insulin resistance or pre-diabetes is another way of saying it, or some actually diabetes, then getting that under control with some medications can help with you to lose weight. The first step is always, which you've tried, lifestyle modifications, which does include not dieting, but changing your eating patterns to get to a healthy weight, as well as a strict exercise regimen. So I find that if you combine your lifestyle changes with the medications, then that will help you achieve a healthy weight.
Is there a specific diet that is more effective at helping PCOS sufferers lose weight?
You know, I'm not a trained registered dietitian, and so what I will say to that question, since I get asked it most of the time, is from all the research and knowledge that I've done, I primarily think that a caloric restriction diet is key. Yes, there are ways that you can modify the things that you choose in your diet. Like a lot of things you'll read talk about a high glycemic index.
Right.
And so you'll see a lot of literature out there. There are a lot of dietitians out there that are really good at, you know, focusing a diet for a patient with PCOS. However, ultimately, the studies that have been done on either a zone diet, and, you know, I don't want to use any particular words, or going to Weight Watchers. The point is every diet is primarily the same as long as it's including a low-calorie intake. And that's really hard for a lot of patients. And within that low-calorie intake, obviously you're going to want to make healthy food choices. So a registered dietitian, I usually try and have all of my patients see one, because I think that this is not a syndrome that could be taken care of by one physician. I think that you need a team approach in your treatment, and that's where a registered dietitian becomes very important.
I think that makes good sense. How effective are the bariatric weight loss surgeries for those with PCOS? And is it, I guess that's a twofold question. One, is it effective at helping them lose weight? And two, if they lose weight, does it affect the syndrome? Does it affect their symptoms?
Yes, it does. So in my patients that really have tried dieting and exercising and trying some of the medications that we use to help with their pre-diabetic disposition or high levels of insulin, if it's not working, I do recommend bariatric surgery. And it has been shown to help women regulate their periods, decrease their insulin levels, which in turn will decrease their male hormone levels and many of their symptoms, prevent them from the long-term sequelae of developing diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease. So for all these reasons, if a patient really is not successful and they are committed to a lifestyle change, then I would recommend bariatric surgery.
I know you're not a bariatric surgeon, but is there any specific of the different types of bariatric surgeries out there? Are there any that have been shown through research to be most affected at maintaining long-term loss?
I don't want to misspeak for anybody out there, but I would definitely refer that to the bariatric surgeons.
Okay. All righty. Now, let's move on to talking about treatment options for PCOS.
Okay. Can I just mention one other thing that I left out that I think is important for all the listeners to hear?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So in terms of the blood tests that I was talking about, we did hit on the majority of the ones that I do evaluate. But since we're going back and forth with the issue of diabetes, overweight, insulin, in all of my PCOS patients and in those that are suffering from it, I would recommend an annual at least screening for diabetes. And there isn't one perfect test on how to screen for diabetes. Most internists or generalists may do a more basic test. Again, I'm not trying to generalize, but usually the patients coming into my office say, yep, I've been screened for diabetes, and I get maybe one lab value. I do have my patients go through what's called an oral glucose tolerance test. And this is more of a sugar challenge on their body to see how well they respond to a high sugar load. And if they really do fall into either, again, I don't, medically there's not really a word pre-diabetes, but there's a range that if your levels aren't exactly diabetic, but they're in an intermediate zone, then that is a worrisome group of patients. And in those patients, or of course a diabetic patient, I would strongly encourage the medications that I was referring to that can help with insulin control. So as part of the lab test, I do think every patient out there should be ruled out for other endocrine problems, but as well as diabetes.
Okay. All right. So that goes back to the when you're initially being diagnosed. When we talk about treatment options, I would imagine it would depend on what you find in those tests, what exactly are the symptoms. So, but analyzing it that way, what are your options as far as treatment?
Well, again, exactly as you said, the options really depend on what the patient's complaining of. So when I sit with a patient, if they're complaining of irregular periods, which the majority of them are, then you want to do something that's going to help regulate their period. And that is why really the first-line treatment in patients with PCOS is to put them on a combined oral contraceptive pill. Now, this does not take away the reason why they're having irregular cycles, and they will think that they're having regular periods because these medications will mimic a regular menstrual cycle. But if they go off those medications and their body is still in an irregular zone, which most of them will, they will go back to having irregular periods. So it's just masking their complaint, but it's also helping with some of their symptoms, meaning regulating their period, as well as their male symptoms. It often will help with either acne or hirsutism. And it also does something important, which is preventing the uterus from developing any abnormal cells or overgrowth of tissue if they're not having regular menstrual periods. Because it is a population of patients that are at higher risk for developing pathologies, which could include cancer in their uterus.
We actually have a question on that. Let me go ahead and get it in now. This one's from Lucille. Are endometriosis and PCOS in any way related? I have PCOS and my twin sister has severe endometriosis.
The best answer to that question is no.
Oh, okay.
There are two different gynecologic problems that women often will complain of, and endometriosis is when the tissue that lines the inner part of your uterus actually starts to grow outside of your uterus or in parts not where it's supposed to be. And then anytime you get a period, that tissue sheds just as if it does through the vagina and gives you a period. And that's really the hallmark of endometriosis. It's not to say that you can't have both, but they don't usually go hand in hand.
They're not connected in that way.
They're not connected.
All right, going back to the treatment issues, it seems to me that by taking oral contraceptives, one, if you're trying to conceive, that would be obviously a problem there. Number two, as you point out, it's simply masking the symptom of irregular period. It's giving you a false period, if so to speak. I guess it does help with some of the symptoms of the excessive male hormones. But if a patient is trying to conceive, and if that's one of the symptoms they come to you with, obviously birth control is counterintuitive.
Exactly. So that's why you have to ask the patient first off, I say when they walk into my office, what is it about the syndrome that is bothering you the most, and how can I help you? Because if they're having irregular periods and they're not planning on getting pregnant, I would most likely, if losing weight with exercise and appropriate diet modifications isn't helping to help regulate their period, which sometimes that alone will, the majority of patients I will say it's best to go on a birth control pill. So that would be someone who does not want to conceive. There mm-hmm. are other ways, but if they are trying to conceive, then the conversation goes in a different direction.
All right. So what are symptoms? So birth control is your first line, and then
if it's somebody who's not planning on getting pregnant, and mm-hmm. if a patient is complaining of more of the male, you know, there are patients that do get what they think of as regular menstrual cycles, and if they're true ovulatory cycles and they're just complaining of the male hormone aspect, then there are medications that I use to target those complaints as well. I do like ideally to have my patients on both a birth control pill as well as one of these anti-male hormones, because I don't want them getting pregnant while they're taking those medications, because the majority of them are not safe in pregnancy if they have an accidental conception.
Okay.
So,
go ahead.
So in patients, again, that do not have any fertility issues and they're either complaining of the acne or the hirsutism and their regular periods, which the majority of patients come in with that presentation, the combination usually starts with some type of protection of the uterus with a birth control pill plus some type of anti-male hormone to help target those other symptoms, plus or minus adding a medication that will help with the insulin issue if their testing comes back irregular or if I see signs on their body of high insulin levels.
If they, and is that metformin is the
yes.
medication that we often hear
yes.
patients taking who have insulin issues. What if a patient is, insulin levels come back normal? Is there any advantage to taking one of the insulin regulating medications?
Yeah, there could be, because again, there's no perfect lab test to help diagnose insulin resistance unless you're going to subject a patient to sitting in a laboratory and having a series of consecutive tests over a period of time. So just because we don't pick it up necessarily on one test that we do doesn't mean that they may not have some underlying insulin resistance. So patients, I do explain what metformin is to them, and sometimes I use it as empiric treatment, meaning I don't really know for sure if this patient has it, but they have PCOS and they're having issues with the weight loss, and I think it augments their behavioral modification. So I will often use it as well.
Does that medication, and I guess metformin is simply a brand, and there may be others as far as I know, does the insulin-resistant medication help with weight loss?
Yes, because it's not going to take away your weight. It's not a magic drug. In the very beginning of going on one of those pills, often patients will drop quite a few pounds because it does have some malabsorptive effect, and so either the patient complains of some gastrointestinal complaints that the food's sort of running through them quicker. So from that mm-hmm. standpoint, they do sometimes indirectly lose weight. But if patients have high insulin levels, then that means that they're not able to use the sugar. The food that goes into their mouth that turns into sugars or glucose has to get broken down by something, and it's broken down by insulin. Insulin helps it go to the right places it needs to in the body, whether it's the muscle or the fat. And if you have your insulin's not working so well, then it's harder for them to break down those sugars, and they tend to gain weight. So if you get their insulin under control, then it will indirectly help them lose weight.
Especially if combined with lifestyle changes.
Exactly. If I don't think the patient's committed to really restructuring what they're eating and really committing to a standard exercise regimen, then I do try and educate them that metformin is, it may help a bit, but it's not really going to take away all their problems.
You are listening to Creating a Family, talk about infertility and adoption, and today we're talking about polycystic ovarian syndrome with Dr. Allison Peck. She is a reproductive endocrinologist specializing in the treatment of PCOS, and she is with the Fertility Institute's Endocrine Disorder Division, and that is located near Los Angeles. Here's a question we received. She says, I'm 40 and in menopause, and I also have PCOS. I am currently on metformin. Does PCOS go away after menopause? Does PCOS cause premature menopause?
Good question. I have had quite a few patients come in that are postmenopausal worrying about PCOS. Really, PCOS is a disease of reproductive age women. That means women who are still in their reproductive years. If you previously had polycystic ovarian syndrome and now you're going into menopause, there could be some overlap there because patients with PCOS do eventually go into menopause as well, but it does not cause premature ovarian failure. Some of this are premature ovarian insufficiency. There's a lot of different terminology for women that go into an earlier menopause.
So does that mean that the symptoms of PCOS will go away once you stop having periods and you are completely through menopause?
Well, it depends again what your symptom is. Obviously, you're not going to get any more periods, so that's not going to be an issue. You're going to have an irregular period. You're just not going to have one.
Yeah.
One of the other symptoms, the male hormones, it depends. I mean, if you spent a lifetime of having, you know, more and more male symptomatology and hair growth, oftentimes once the hairs have been activated and turned from vellus, which is the soft hairs, to more terminal, dark, coarser hairs, it's hard to reset that system. You may not have the same male hormone drive to promote even more of a growth, but it's not going to all of a sudden disappear, the hair growth that has already developed.
Well,
that would answer that question.
That's kind of a double-edged sword, isn't it? Yeah.
Exactly. It's kind of a hard question to answer. It's a very good question. But when women go into menopause, as women age in general, they do sometimes start to develop some new hairs on their chin or on the sides of their face, and that does not mean that they have PCOS.
Do you see more, if a woman has had some of the symptoms of excessive male hormones when she is younger, once she goes through menopause, is she more likely to see some of the symptoms of male pattern baldness?
I haven't seen that.
Good, that would really stink.
Right.
Yeah, that would be
that would be
so,
very bad. I mean, women do totally tend to lose hair as well as they age,
yeah,
but I don't see it more frequently in women who have already gone through that.
Okay.
Unfortunately, that's one of the tougher areas to treat. It's very, you know, it's very hard for women to go through a hair loss at a younger age and an older age. But, you know, the patients that suffer from PCOS and have the hair loss, it is a little bit tougher. It doesn't mean it's not, there aren't things out there for them, but oftentimes I struggle with those patients.
All right. Now let's move on to talking about PCOS and fertility. What percentage of the patients you see, or overall, if you know of research out there, of PCOS patients are infertile? And I guess by infertile, we would define that as an inability to conceive without using birth control for a year if you're under the age of 35, and I guess 6 months if you're over 35.
Right. So the majority of patients that truly have polycystic ovarian syndrome will have problems conceiving. And that's because the whole nature of the syndrome, like we talked about before, was that they're not getting regular periods, so they're not ovulating on a regular basis. And since they're not ovulating regularly, they don't know when to have intercourse. And some don't even ovulate at all. So for the most part, I would say the majority of patients with true PCOS that don't get their periods will suffer from some type of infertility. Doesn't mean that they're not very fertile people and they can very easily get pregnant in the majority of cases, but you need to reset their ovulation pattern. So most of them will come in needing help.
How do you reset their ovulation pattern?
Well, you either try to, you know, if you haven't been able to, if they were not able to do it themselves with getting onto a health, you know, losing weight, which sometimes alone, that's all it'll take, and they're not getting that regular cycle, then there are medications that they can take that will help promote the growth of an egg each month to allow
Would
them
that
to ovulate.
Medications like Clomid?
Exactly. I usually, you know, depending on the age of the patient and what, you know, if they have any other fertility issues, then I usually would start first line with Clomid.
And well, maybe this is a silly question, but if you have cysts on your ovaries, multiple cysts on your ovaries, It seems like taking a drug that is going, an ovulatory-inducing drug that will create cyst would be counterintuitive.
I can see where you're coming from, but cysts on your ovaries, these cysts, people sometimes don't understand that all women walking around have little cysts on their ovaries. The definition of a cyst is just a fluid-filled sac. It's just that patients with PCOS have more of those, and they don't regularly, you know, every woman has a set of eggs, let's say, that get ready to develop in their menstrual month. When they get their period on day one, there's a group of eggs that really wanted to grow that month, anywhere from 10 to 20 eggs. And of those, our brain works with our ovaries to help make it so that only one really develops bigger than the rest of them. And the other ones just die off. And the one goes on and ovulates and gets released. In patients with PCOS, all those little ones just stay there. They're stagnant. The hormone environment in their body, the high male hormones, potentially the insulin, doesn't allow their body and their brain to send the appropriate signals to allow them to have just that recruitment of one egg from the batch.
Mm-hmm.
So Clomid helps do that. It doesn't create more cysts. It allows the hormone environment to be optimal so that one of those, ideally, sometimes more end up happening, and that's why there is a, you know, about a, on anywhere from 5 to 10% multiple pregnancy rate in patients that do take Clomid. But ideally for anovulators, people who don't ovulate, Clomid is a great drug to help them recruit ideally one egg that month that they otherwise wouldn't be doing.
So it is Clomid enough for most of your patients to achieve a pregnancy?
You know, about 80% of patients will ovulate on Clomid, and about 40% of those will become pregnant. So in that sense, you know, in those patients, yes, it's enough. Usually I don't do more than anywhere, you know, up to maybe six cycles. And sometimes, you know, they've already been started with their OBGYN for a while, and that's already not working. So by the time they come to me, I'm more aggressive. But Clomid helps them even the playing field because they're not real. They are infertile because they're not, you know, they fall into the definition of infertility, but they're infertile because their body hasn't had the chance to even make that egg. So when you put them on Clomid for about 6 months or so and you check to see that they're actually ovulating, they're very similar to any other patient out there if they're ovulating.
So Clomid, I like that. Kind of evens the playing field.
Right. So if they're ovulating on Clomid and 6 months has gone by and they're not pregnant, then you're starting to worry a little bit that they're not going to get pregnant with Clomid. And that's when, you know, there are some people that you put on Clomid and they don't ovulate, even if you increase the dosing of it. So it's very important if you are put on Clomid that your doctor does do something to confirm that you actually ovulated on that dose. And if you ovulated on that dose and you're still not getting pregnant, then you have to start thinking of other things, like adding other medications to the Clomid would be one way, or changing completely to a different type of medication, which are called gonadotropins, would be another way. And ultimately,
and those are injectable, is that correct?
Exactly. You know, Okay. Hopefully you don't have to turn to that, but at some point you may. And beyond that, you know, there's a surgery that can be performed on some of those cysts. They don't take away the cysts. I have so many patients come to me and say, well, you see all those cysts. Can't you just take them all away? No, because your body's going to make them again. It's a chronic syndrome. So, no, we can't do that. But there are some surgeries. I don't often do them, but they absolutely can be done, and they have been shown to be helpful in some patients that are resistant to Clomid or some of the other forms of medications. It's called ovarian drilling, where you take a little laser. You can use other modalities, but take a laser, and you kind of burn those follicles, burn some of those cysts away. And some patients will respond to that, and their body will jumpstart into having a regular ovulation for a couple months after the surgery.
So it's the existence, and potentially it is the existence of the cyst which is preventing ovulation?
Yeah, it's actually the high insulin environment, the high male hormone environment that are keeping the ovaries stagnant. And instead of allowing cysts to develop into larger follicles each month, they just stay there.
Okay.
They reset our brain and tell our brain, don't do what you normally do because, you know, and help me make that egg that I need to this month. And so their system is just kind of frozen.
So it's possible that that's a way of jump-starting, so to speak, the body. By removing those, the patient might be able to start ovulating again.
On their own. And if you can't do it that way, then you use some type of medication, ideally either Clomid or the gonadotropins, which somehow tricks your brain into thinking that it's able to do a normal cycle. And once you kind of wake up the brain that way, or you give the hormone that the brain usually would give, it allows the ovaries to respond. And then they wake up because they have plenty of eggs. It's
right.
Not that they don't have eggs. It's that their eggs don't know what to do because they're not getting the right signals from their brain to do that every month. So I do give them a lot of faith, these patients, because they happen to be very fertile people. You know, just because you have PCOS doesn't mean that you can't have children. In fact, you have to be careful when you give them these medications that they don't make too many eggs, which is something that they often do, or that they have, you know, too much ovulation to make multiple babies.
Exactly.
They just need some help to reset their system. And so I usually tell them, look, if you're coming in for non-fertility issues, then we're going to help treat your symptoms until you're ready to have children. And when you're ready to have children, I encourage them to go sooner than later to either their OBGYN or a reproductive endocrinologist to help them get pregnant so they don't spend time trying off the pill for too long to wind up in an age, you know, I hate to say this to some of those listeners, but once a woman hits 35, fertility in general starts to decline, and I usually try and encourage them not to wait at least that long if they're thinking, you know, because they're going to have, they may need a couple of different treatments to get there, may not happen overnight. So I do warn them ahead of time that we'll keep you on these medicines to keep your symptoms in control and try and prevent long-term problems. But when you want to get pregnant, that should be your biggest priority. And you got to get quick to somebody who's going to help you.
Does having PCOS increase the odds of having a miscarriage?
You know, if you look at the literature, there are plenty of studies that will support that. So I would say yes to that question.
So even once you get pregnant, you may not be able to carry the PCOS may interfere with the continuation of that pregnancy.
Potentially. I mean, again, studies have shown that in patients with PCOS, they do have a higher chance of having a miscarriage.
Here's a question from Melanie. She says, if I were to get pregnant, would I have to stop taking my PCOS meds? And she did not say what meds she was on.
If she's on any of the medications that are the anti-male hormone type things that try and target production of male hormone, the majority of them would be dangerous to a developing fetus, especially if it's male, because it would then, you know, some
right.
of them would cross the placenta and then make the male genital organs not, look female.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right,
yes,
that makes
to that. Obviously, you're going to have to go off the birth control pill if that's what you're taking. And, you know, some women have an IUD in place that gives off the hormone progesterone. Some women take cyclic progesterone to try and give them a regular bleed every month. Those things would, of course, be contraindicated in pregnancy. And if you're on a medication for the, you know, insulin resistance or, you know, you're using metformin in that way, then really it depends on where you are in the world if it's okay to use that in pregnancy. At this point in time, most OBs will not continue it all the way through pregnancy, but some may. So the only one I'd say that is potentially okay to stay on would maybe be your metformin if you're taking that, if that's something you've discussed with your physician.
But that needs to be something that you talk with your physician, and a lot may depend on dosage and other things as that.
That's fair to say.
What are some of the long-term health implications associated with PCOS? We've talked about it being a chronic disease, and we've talked about the symptoms that might bring you in originally, things such as the symptoms of excessive male hormones in an irregular menstrual cycle. But long-term, are there other health effects that PCOS sufferers are more likely to be prone to?
Yes. I may have mentioned it before, but to repeat, absolutely heart disease, developing high blood pressure, or developing abnormalities in their lipids, which could lead to high cholesterol and things like that. So it's part of what's called the metabolic syndrome, which some of your listeners may be familiar with, but kind of a concoction of, you know, markers for heart disease or, like I mentioned, high blood pressure or abnormal lipids, they fall into, and obesity, they all fall in, and diabetes, which, you know, we've discussed, but they all fall into this syndrome that then turns into the metabolic syndrome, which is very common in patients with PCOS. And those are things you want to try and avoid, especially, and the way you can avoid those is exactly the same way. Sometimes it's using medication. Sometimes the majority of it is education and trying to teach them as much as they can to get that weight down and to continue at a lower weight. And that usually will help with bringing their blood pressure down or their lipids down. But sometimes there are some other medications like the statin family, which is becoming newer in the field of PCOS. Some doctors are using that. And that has been shown to sometimes help with the symptoms of PCOS as well. But to answer your question, it's really the heart disease, high blood pressure, abnormal lipids, diabetes. That would be long-term risks.
So I guess it would be fair to say that if left untreated, PCOS can life-threatening, but I guess it could affect your longevity.
Yes. Well, yeah. If it's related to having one of these other syndromes.
Right.
These other diseases.
And
I don't know offhand of any reports that have said that patients with PCOS die younger than patients that don't have it.
But we know people with heart disease
exactly.
Die earlier.
Exactly.
People with diabetes die earlier. People who
exactly.
are overweight die earlier. Well, obese anyway, die
right.
earlier.
So it depends on if you also develop one of these other conditions. You know, because of your PCOS.
Let's talk about alternative treatments and supplements that you know of or you've read research on that might be effective at treating the symptoms of polycystic ovarian syndrome. Let's talk first about supplements, and then I'd like to move into discussing alternative treatments or complementary treatments. Do you know of any supplements that have any support in research at being effective for controlling symptoms?
You know, offhand, this question I get a lot also. I am a very westernized doctor, and I believe, you know, again, mostly in the facts that I've learned from my way of learning, but I'm open to the idea of talking about supplements, but I haven't found them to be as effective in my population of patients. So usually I'd have to see exactly what they've been recommended for me to promote that's going to take away their symptoms, especially when it comes to getting their period naturally.
Okay, and what about for excessive male hormones?
I would say the same. You know, the medications that we use for excessive male hormones are not regulated specifically for patients with PCOS. They're used for other things, but we use them in our population because they have been found to be effective.
Okay, and so you don't, as far as supplements that might be effective for that.
Yeah, I mean, there are supplements to help with cholesterol panels, you know, if their cholesterol is off, but for the most part, I don't recommend, I usually start with the things that I am most comfortable with.
All right, now let's talk about alternative treatments, either different forms of Chinese medicine, acupuncture, acupressure, things such as that. Have you read anything that would indicate that that might be effective?
Yeah, I've absolutely read about acupuncture and, you know, to complement just getting their qi in order. So I would say to any patient that's open to that, I would encourage it, not alone, but I would definitely encourage it. I think that any time you mix Western and Eastern medicine, then ideally you're going to come out with the best result. But I definitely know of literature that supports acupuncture in patients with PCOS.
Okay, so that would be something then to consider as well. We have an email that just came in. A woman is asking, she said her mom has PCOS. She's 25, and the questioner is 25, wants to know what her odds are of developing, and is there anything she should be doing now? She has none of the symptoms.
No, that's a really good question. Women that do have PCOS, I would educate your female daughters once they hit getting their periods. Just pay attention to make sure those periods really are regular and to watch for these symptoms. If you're not having any symptoms now and you truly are getting regular periods, not being on a birth control pill for other reasons, then I would just watch that you can maintain a healthy weight for your height and you're well educated about your diet, you understand nutrition and how you need to make healthy food choices and a regular exercise regimen long term, and probably annually see your physician to make sure that you're not some of the symptoms don't start to develop. And if they do, I would get treatment sooner than later. The longer you wait to get anything done, often the harder it is to treat it once you present to the doctor.
That makes good sense. I hadn't thought about that, but your point about with the hair growth is that even with treatment, even if effectively reducing the hair growth, once the hair follicles or the hair cells, hair production cells have changed, changing them back is problematic.
Exactly, because the medicines that we use will help prevent the drive to make those hairs want to come out, but it's not going to take away the hair that's already there. You need to combine some type of treatment. There's so many different ways, whether it's waxing, plucking, shaving, laser. Laser's really taken the head of the majority of those, but that really needs to be combined with whatever type of medical treatment we're trying to get those patients to use.
Here's a question from Beth. How long should I continue to take or stay on Clomid?
That's a good question. I'd need to probably know a little bit more about the story, but if you're ovulating regularly on Clomid, I would usually, and again, my main focus is getting the pregnancy in the safest way possible, but normally it's at least up to 6 cycles. I would say then you need to start being more aggressive. In the past, women have gone, up to 12 cycles if you're ovulating each month. After that, I would definitely not continue to use anymore. There were some studies in the past that showed that, not great studies, but definitely some studies that have, put the brakes on a lot of reproductive endocrinologists, that after 12 cycles, those women could be potentially at risk for developing some abnormal tumor cells in their ovaries if they had done multiple cycles of Clomid with never having conceived. So 12 cycles, really that magic number that most our reproductive endocrinologists won't cross. But, without knowing more information, I would usually say somewhere between, somewhere up to around 6, I would start making a change. And sometimes even before that, depending on how old you are. If a 38-year-old woman came to me with PCOS, and, I'm not going to spend 6 to 12 months of putting her on Clomid. But she's 20 years old or 25 years old, and I know we have a lot of time and options, and that's the only fertility issue, I would be more lenient as to keeping her on Clomid longer if she's responding.
As with always, when we're speaking of fertility issue, age makes such a difference.
It really does.
Yes, thank you so much, Dr. Peck, for being our guest today to talk about PCOS on Creating a Family. For our listeners who want more information on Dr. Peck, she can be found, or information of where she practices can be found at, and I love this domain name, polycysticovaries.com.
Org.
Okay, gosh, I'm glad you corrected me. Polycysticovaries.org. If you have found the show helpful, please post about it and link to it so others can listen as well. It will be archived on the 2010 Big List on the radio page at creatingafamily.org, and it's also available for a download as a podcast from iTunes. You can find it at the iTunes store, but the easiest way is to click on the iTunes button on our radio page, and that will take you directly there. To stay in touch with the latest and greatest developments in infertility and adoption, as well as receiving the upcoming week's blog and show topics, sign up for our weekly newsletter at any of the pages of creatingafamily.org. I have 2 quick announcements to make. One, the PBS show Point of View, which recently in September brought us a series of documentaries on adoption, is having a video contest for adoptive families titled This Is My Family. You might be able to win an iPad or an iTouch if your video is chosen. So you can find them, go to the PBS Public Broadcasting System, but it would be pbs.org/POV, which would stand for Point of View, / This Is My Family. And we want to see a lot of videos submitted for that. Also, the support group Families for Russian and Ukrainian Adoption, otherwise known as FRUA, will host its 7th Annual Education Conference on October 15th and 16th at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. They always put on a wonderfully informative conference. You can get more information at their website, FRUA, FRUA.org. Next week's show, October 13th, will be on Homeland Tours. Thank you so much for joining us today, and I will see you next week.
Thank you.